Hey there, it's Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR. Before we get into the next episode, I wanted to ask that you subscribe to the show. It'll help us get even more unique and interesting guests on the podcast, and in turn, continue to educate management teams and the growing ecosystem that creates value for fast-growing private and public companies. And while you're at it, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. Very much appreciated. This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships, and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more.
While neither Tom Ryan nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor is Tom a client of IEQ Capital, ICR must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respected personal views and do not reflect the opinions or review of IEQ Capital.
When you step back and you look at tech disruption of industries over the past 20 or 30 years, the reality is that the industry that has been slowest to innovate and in notional terms is the most valuable is actually the financial services industry.
It's pretty amazing to be witnessing a global shift in financial technology, especially when you have a window into the incredible changes to come.
What I think will likely be the most valuable use case for this technology will be the disruption of financial services and specifically how asset values get traded and moved back and forth among parties.
Being a public company can be hard. Small missteps can have outsized consequences. I'm Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR, and over the last 25 years, we've helped thousands of companies understand and navigate the stock market and the media. We'll demystify these and other increasingly complex stakeholder groups so you can focus on what you do best, building your company and unlocking your true potential. This is Welcome to the Arena from ICR. As the world begins to embrace cryptocurrency, blockchain technology, and deregulated finance, there's a massive transformation on the horizon. But if you're going to be investing in these areas, you need to be incredibly diligent and have a deep understanding of the technology and the risks. Today's guest has both. We're sitting down with Pete Najarian, who is the managing partner of RW3 Ventures. RW3 is a digital asset venture firm built in partnership with the Raptor Group. The Raptor Group is a multi-sector venture firm with significant investments across fintech, sports and gaming, healthcare, and digital assets. Pete has significant dedicated digital asset experience, having previously served in senior leadership roles for two leading digital asset operating businesses, Zappo, which was ultimately acquired by Coinbase in 2019, and BitGo, the leader in digital asset security, custody, and liquidity. They provide the operational backbone for more than 1,500 institutional clients and over 50 companies. They also process 20% of all the global Bitcoin transactions by value. Prior to that, Pete spent over 20 years building and leading global emerging market businesses for some of the world's largest banks. Let's enter the arena with Pete Najarian.
I had a career in emerging markets, and when you're in a role like that, you spend a lot of time in country and a lot of funky places all over the world, kind of helping build out and finance local capital market systems. I found that there was kind of a common thread in all of those, which was that like the biggest determinant of a nation's ability to emerge was really centered around the ability of the citizens of that country to save and invest in a home currency that wasn't in constant threat of devaluation. So, which was typically the case, almost always the case. So through that, I found Bitcoin. I mean, I first started messing around as an investor in Bitcoin and Ethereum in kind of mid-2017. And it just made sense to me early, largely because of the store of value use case of Bitcoin, having spent so much time in big societies where the population was struggling just to hold any value in local currency terms. You know, if you grew up in the West, you don't think about store of value as a thing. If you grew up in an emerging economy, it's often all you think about.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I would imagine that, you know, a lot of people living in the States here just don't fully appreciate, you know, there aren't like $100 bills, you know, raining down on these countries. They have to put their money in some store of value that they feel is secure, right?
And dollars are scarce, and that's kind of misunderstood in the West. And so that made sense to me. I was invested and involved in learning. And then I just got super lucky. I actually met a guy who was one of the original thought leaders of kind of the Bitcoin movement overall, and a guy named Wences Cazares, who had founded really what was the first true custodian of crypto assets. And he wanted to build it into an institutional business from what was originally kind of a retail orientation. And that really fit my background. So he invited me to join, and I did. And we built that up very quickly. And within about 2 years, sold it to Coinbase to kind of relaunch their institutional business. And on that sale, I actually went to what at the time was Coinbase's biggest competitor, a company called BitGo. And the story there got even more interesting. We grew, you know, having spent 20 years in traditional finance, the explosion of growth that happened at BitGo, I've never seen before, and I probably won't see again. We actually grew the asset base from 100 million in assets to 65 billion in assets in 24 months.
It's ridiculous.
So just crazy growth. And had a bunch of different acquirers come to us to try and get involved in the business. And in the middle of that whole thing, I got introduced to the Raptor Group and Jim Pallotta, who's the founder of the Raptor Group.
Yep.
Another fascinating guy. And through that relationship and as we got to know each other better, we ultimately came to the development of RW3 Ventures, which RW3 really stands for Raptor Web 3. And what that really meant was that we launched a new entity, Raptor, and that infrastructure we were able to build on top of. We were able to take advantage of a great Rolodex of relationships beyond our own, which helped with our raise and really has kind of made the launch pretty seamless.
Yeah. And what do you guys focus on? What are you really looking for to invest in and at what stage?
In the digital asset venture world, it's clearly not as mature as what you see in kind of traditional venture. It's definitely more varied in our world, but we tend to trend towards earlier is better, where we can write smaller checks for bigger ownership positions, but also have a kind of outsized impact on the growth of the businesses that we fund. I would say typically we're pre-seed out to Series A, but the lion's share of what we've done so far in the portfolio has been kind of what I would call pure seed stage. So it's beyond an idea. They're fairly well along in their build, but they have a lot of work to do from a biz dev perspective to kind of prove product market fit with a larger audience.
Yeah. So before we get on the rabbit hole on all this stuff, most people who just like kind of casually study or observe like the crypto markets in particular, they're glued to Bitcoin and the Bitcoin watch on CNBC. I wanted to ask you, at what price of Bitcoin do you start becoming very popular at cocktail parties?
It's more the pace. It depends on the pace of explosion, right?
Yeah.
So oddly, and this sounds perverse, but it's been a funny experience. I think I was more popular at cocktail parties for this conversation the last time it rallied than this time. Because in the last rally, we went to 68,000 per Bitcoin.
And that's like when your phone blows up, right? Right at the top.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's all, unfortunately, that's all anybody wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So I was kind of hiding from cocktail parties. But this time around, it actually, we've passed those levels.
Yep.
In this rally that has largely taken place kind of from the second half of this year through to now. And most people missed it.
Yeah.
Right. There was a lot more retail discussion around ownership of Bitcoin and what else should I be buying kind of questions, you know, in November of 21 than there is today. It does feel to me like the market rallied like crazy. They kind of watched that portfolio go all the way up and all the way back down and then sold probably at a bad price. So, yeah, it's a funny question, but perversely, people are less focused today, which is, I think, kind of the wrong orientation than they were in the last hype cycle.
Maybe we step back and start with the bigger picture. How do you kind of categorize the industry overall right now? You know, like we said, Bitcoin gets a lot of press, but how's that different from a lot of the other chains and cryptocurrencies that are public and active?
That's a great question. There are a couple of kind of core lanes that are differentiated, and there's a lot of everything else outside those lanes, which is untouchable, which is uninvestable, frankly.
Yeah.
And it really does start with Bitcoin. So think of Bitcoin as the index, or it's a bad analogy, but think of index as kind of the treasury curve, if you will, of an asset class or of a group of assets. And Bitcoin is largely winning the lane of a store of value use case.
Right.
And that's why people talk about it as digital gold. And there are some very specific reasons for that that are kind of characteristic to the way the code was written and the chain was built. But assume that Bitcoin is not necessarily a payments network, not necessarily a substitute for a dollar or a currency, but is more akin to a digital representation of a unit of value like gold that has a finite amount and satisfies many of the other characteristics of what people would kind of consider the perfect store of value, portability, fungibility, et cetera.
Yep.
And that they've won that lane, and that lane is an important lane. And as I said in the open, it's a critical lane in parts of the world, frankly, that are only growing. Next to Bitcoin, and the next big innovation that happened after Bitcoin was a blockchain called the Ethereum blockchain. And the Ethereum blockchain came with an innovation that really changed the game overall. And what that innovation was effectively a platform of code where you could code transactions to happen, delivering value to specific people if certain metrics were met.
Like you and I could do a transaction.
We could do a transaction. So what that innovation unlocked was a world in which you can start to imagine blockchains as operating systems. So if you think about the internet that we're all used to, there's an underlying operating system that drives all of that.
Right.
And applications like Facebook or Uber, et cetera, are effectively built on top of that operating system.
Okay. The light bulb went off there for me. Makes total sense.
And the difference, there are a couple core differences. You hear people talk about Web 2 and Web 3. If you go back to what was considered Web 1, Web 1 was read-only internet, right? You didn't really interact with it. It was originally used for universities to move documents around back and forth. That turned into a new version of internet use, which has effectively been called now Web 2, which is a read-write universe, meaning I can read and I can write to it as well using applications to do that. And that's really what the application growth has been, right? Web 3 is moving to a next concept, which is effectively read, write, and own. So you actually can buy Ether tokens and own via a staking mechanism a piece of the operating system. Nobody owns the operating system which Web 2 runs on. These blockchains, if you consider them operating systems, are now read, write, and own, which is a pretty massive innovation.
Yeah. Completely. And what do you consider the core use cases for all of this technology? Like, how will it be used in the real world?
I mean, that's something we debate every day.
Yeah.
And in truth, beyond store of value, beyond Bitcoin, and I think store of value is the use case that's a fundamentally important use case and has—
I totally agree.
And has huge implications. And interestingly, you're now seeing it matter in the West, right? Like you're seeing it matter in countries like the United States where store value didn't matter much.
The dollar has been declining for decades.
It's a bit of a race to the bottom for all these currencies next to hard assets, right? But looking for use cases beyond that, it's vast. So the opportunities are vast, but then where does the flywheel really get spinning to take advantage of the opportunities is still a question mark. You're hearing a lot and reading a lot, and the big banks are driving this now on the concept of tokenizing real-world assets. Basically, what that means, and where I think a fundamental change is coming, and I do believe it's a massive shift over a period of years, because of the way blockchains work and because of how you can tokenize a thing all of that technology utilizing digital wallets to hold those tokens actually creates a world where anything of value can be transferred between parties in real time, in seconds, at almost no cost. And when you step back and you look at tech disruption of industries over the past 20 or 30 years, the reality is that the industry that has been slowest to innovate and in notional terms is the most valuable is actually the financial services industry. So, you know, traditional financial services is still settling transactions on the same rails it has been for the last 30 years, while everything else, telecom, everything else has been through a pretty significant tech-driven period of disruption. And what I think will likely be the most valuable use case for this technology will be the disruption of financial services and specifically how asset values get traded and moved back and forth among parties.
There are tons of new developments to get excited about and hundreds of potential projects for Pete and his team to invest in. So for me, the big question is, how does he evaluate them and which ones excite him the most?
We have kind of like five boxes that you have to check to get through our hurdle. We see a ridiculous amount of deal flow for a fund of our size. I mean, I think we've looked at, we ran through our data recently and we'd already looked at like 1,100 opportunities in 20 months.
Yeah.
And we've made 30 investments. So you can imagine how picky we are.
Yep.
So there's some kind of critical things for us, but stepping back, you have to kind of ask yourself thematically, what are the use cases that matter here? Who's going to win? And then within the use cases I like and the themes where I think there's a disruptive opportunity that's somewhat less competitive, what are the other attributes that a startup needs to have to matter for us? We made an investment in a blockchain-based medical records business. And they realized that couple fundamental problems. Number one, all of these systems that have been built, that have been well-funded, have been somewhat funded as bespoke systems, they don't talk to each other. Hospitals and doctors and diagnostic testing units, et cetera, lab testing, they don't talk to each other well, number one. And number two, as these industries grow and become international industries, there's different compliance and regulatory reality in each of these different jurisdictions. And that whole thing is incredibly expensive to get right because there's not really been a tech way to do that, to connect that effectively.
Yeah, total nightmare.
And blockchains are perfect for that because blockchains allow for you to take units of data and use smart contracts to pre-code who can see what, and use effectively what's called API connectivity. And if you API connect and allow that system to be built properly, only the right eyeballs can see that data. But that data becomes a single source of truth that's uneditable, where the universe of folks that can see what they're permissioned to see in exactly the right way and can't ever be compromised or edited. So it's kind of perfect tech for that. And now this business, we funded at a really low valuation. And they're about to sign a partnership with one of the biggest lab testing companies in the US. So perfect use case for blockchain, not a very competitive space from other folks that do what we do. And a group of entrepreneurs that are very good in health tech, but we could add a lot of value in terms of blockchain decisions and what chain to build on, how to build, et cetera, et cetera.
A lot of people have money and expertise. What I know that you bring to the table is really a great network of experts, right? Between operators, engineers, other blockchain-centric entrepreneurs. Talk about that network and how you can help maybe someone who is a super intelligent entrepreneur doing this, but maybe someone who's never scaled a business before. How do you kind of get in there and help them?
So first, thanks for saying that. We've been super lucky. I mean, I didn't understand the value. When you launch a crypto-centric business, one of the first decisions you have to make is, who's my digital wallet infrastructure partner? It's literally like, who's my bank?
Yeah.
And that meant that we met everybody from the time they were launching of what turned out to be some of the biggest crypto firms in the marketplace. I find two big flaws in the builds that I see. Typically, this is when, you know, if you take a universe of, you know, 11 or 1200 deals that you've looked at and you get it down to 30, to invest in 30, we went very deep on about 120.
Yeah.
And which means we really like them a lot. And they had made it through our kind of gauntlet of attributes, a lot of them. And often the reason that I killed them was because I wasn't convinced the product market fit was real. And secondly, even if I did like the product market fit, I didn't believe they were going to get the business development side of the business off the ground properly, which really is a nice Silicon Valley way of saying sales.
Yeah.
And I have seen in this asset class a lot of kind of revenue pro formas and financial projections that just kind of felt like fantasy to me relative to what could be possible even in a perfect world from a biz dev perspective. So that's where we often turn folks down. And we spend a lot of time there. I mean, I have 3 calls next week with portfolio companies, with founders, guys we've invested in over the past year, who we like a lot, who we think are doing things well, in which I'm going to press them hard. And each 3 of these calls are the same, basically, on exactly that issue. Where is it working? Where is it not? Where do you need help? Let's together sit down for 1.5 hours and go through our Rolodex and think of what are the relationships that can add value to you. Yeah. And that's how we spend a lot of our time.
Yeah. Well, look, it sounds like a great process. Switching gears a little bit, Pete, how do you view the relationship between traditional finance and kind of the cryptocurrency markets? And like, how would that influence your decision making?
And that's where I was going to go. We've kind of come up with a terminology that's now quickly been stolen by some of our competitors, which is a concept called real world use cases. Everybody talks about real world assets.
Yeah.
And we're looking to invest in businesses that have real world use cases. And what that really means is they have a total addressable market or a TAM that's massive.
Yep.
And they can disrupt an industry like the medical example I used that has a massive TAM. And it's a use case that's meaningful. For financial services, I think the TAM in financial services is larger than anything else we could look at. But I 100% believe that blockchain technology will fundamentally change the way value is moved and transacted, meaning the traditional financial markets rails are going to change and they're going to use blockchain to do that. And then I have a very unpopular view in our industry. And our view is that the incumbents will win. There's a phenomenal piece done by the founder of Benchmark Capital. It talks about how in tech, typically the incumbents of a big enough and powerful enough industry with a strong enough capital base and lobbying body use their own regulators to slow roll regulation long enough that they can eat the innovation themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean,
it's in practice has happened in like 10 industries, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's going to happen in financial services in a meaningful way. And I think it's already happening. I think that's the beginning. You're seeing the beginning of that with the BlackRock ETF. The BlackRock ETF fundamentally changed this asset class.
Totally.
Without question. You'll see other ETFs come along for Ethereum and Solana and Avalanche and others. And this is an important thing to say quickly. There's a difference between crypto assets and crypto technology and blockchain technology, right? So when we talk about ETFs and we talk about, you know, who's going to be able to trade and buy, those are platforms to buy and own and secure crypto assets. But under the hood are blockchains that are driving those crypto assets. And that's where the really interesting stuff is. And I think that there's a ton more innovation coming in how blockchains are built. But I fundamentally believe that we could wake up 5 years from now and all the same major financial institutions will still be the same major financial institutions, JP Morgan and Bank of America and Goldman, et cetera, et cetera. There's this notion among the crypto purists that all of those legacy financial institutions are going to get disrupted and a whole new universe of entities is going to take over.
It's ridiculous.
We think it's ridiculous.
We're old enough to remember 25 years ago when every company thought they were going to revolutionize the world and they were going to knock off every business. A few of them did. You know,
a few
incredible ones did, and that's probably what's going to happen here. But a big majority of them might struggle to, you know, knock off the biggest companies in the world, right?
It wouldn't shock me if we wake up in 5 years and there's a ton of blockchain innovation that's happened all over what was traditional Wall Street. And the only truly branded standalone entity that rose from a crypto native business and is now a big branded financial institution is Coinbase.
Yeah.
And all of the other financial institutions and the names we already have had pre-Coinbase.
Yeah, are just running more efficiently and adopting the technology and all that, right?
Correct. So if you believe that, which we do, that doesn't mean you don't want to invest in that huge lane, which is financial services, blockchain-based financial services, it just means you really want to be funding businesses that are the infrastructure businesses that those companies are going to ultimately buy.
Yeah.
Then you get into the buy versus build.
You're selling picks and shovels, right?
Correct. And you're selling the picks and shovels that the Goldmans of the world don't want to have to build themselves.
Yeah. What's DeFi? What's decentralized finance?
Yeah, now we're a little deeper in the rabbit hole. And this is where there will be a war, a regulatory war, and it's already begun. But if you step back and you think about the concepts we talked about earlier, a blockchain is an operating system, a smart contract can sit on top of a blockchain and can be coded to do certain things. You could build an application on top of Ethereum, for example, in which you and I could trade tokens from wallet to wallet, could trade crypto from wallet to wallet using no intermediary at all. I have it in my digital wallet on my phone. I use an application to trade it to you. And you're anonymous, by the way. You're in Indonesia in an internet cafe, and we just traded Solana tokens via Uniswap. I'll never meet you. I don't know who you are.
Yep.
That transaction gets driven and it gets settled in a blockchain like Ethereum, but it gets driven via an application like Uniswap.
Yeah.
That is a concept and a build concept called decentralized finance or DeFi.
Got it.
That's another place where the debate is hot. So I and the folks in my group don't believe that we're going to live in a world where DeFi gets to operate at an institutional level completely unregulated as it is today. We think there'll be some elements of that trading concept, but that will largely live not in purely open blockchains or open architecture, but in permissioned architecture where you still have to be KYC'd. And there still will be an AML KYC and effective traceability from the regulators.
Yeah. Here's the big concept that you're starting to hear all kinds of noise about, which very polarizing topic, but government, you know, you talked about something gets big enough, the government wants to get into it. What do you think of like central bank digital currencies, you know, with all of the popularity of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies? Do you think the government will get in and squash that and kind of try and do it themselves or?
Well, I don't know that one squashes the other. I think they live alongside each other.
Got it. Okay.
But because a digital dollar in a world of high inflation is still a devaluating instrument, right? There are two things that really scare me in tech. And those two things are AI and central bank digital currencies.
Yeah.
And different takes on the same issue, which is lack of control of the user themselves.
Right.
And so we'll put AI to the side because I'm not...
That's a whole other podcast. Yeah.
And I'm the wrong guy. But I think central bank digital currencies are a thing. I think governments love control.
Totally.
And I think we're in a really perverse moment because technology has created a world in which governments can actually have, in some ways, almost absolute control in ways they couldn't in the past. And this move towards central bank digital currencies is interesting because there's no question it's more efficient. There's no question if you had only altruistic actors, you would want to have completely digitized money. The truth is, what's a dollar, right? Like, what is paper money anyway? We live in the money's already digitized.
Yeah.
But this is programmable money, which means that they can track how it's used and where it's used and what happened, which means they can control it.
Yeah.
And I personally have the same fear that most have around this issue, which is governments are going to use that lever in the wrong way over time.
Yeah.
But I believe it's coming. Because the technology is fully baked for that to happen. And the motivations, unfortunately, are significant. The truth is, if you own a lot of crypto assets, what you'd most love to see is a world in which that became normalized, meaning the use of digital wallets and tokens and everything became normalized, right? And really what central bank digital currencies are just tokenized dollars, right? Or tokenized yen. It's real world assets on steroids, right?
Yep.
So if you own a lot of Bitcoin, you might say, boy, it'd be great if the whole world had digital wallets embedded into how they operate because it's going to make Bitcoin quite valuable. If it's digital gold, it's just digital gold with more buyers now.
Right.
And there are two counters to that. One is central bank digital currencies are a scary notion because I don't have a ton of faith in the operators of those levers of control. And the second is all of the talk that you hear when you're watching folks get on CNBC and they're telling you that they think Bitcoin's going to $1 million of Bitcoin within 4 years or whatever that number is, I'm not sure we want to live in a world where Bitcoin has been forced to $1 million of Bitcoin.
Yeah, some bad stuff probably has to happen.
Pretty bad stuff may have happened by then if there's that much demand for store of value.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Just a couple final thoughts, Pete. I think what you're doing is so cool and fascinating. Any other companies that you've invested in? Because I think that's one of the easiest ways to kind of understand all of this technology and blockchain.
A lot of what we do is infrastructure, and it's a little bit boring. Great businesses, but they're a little bit boring. We funded a crypto-only dedicated insurance business, for example. We do a lot of that kind of stuff. We've invested in different blockchains that we think are innovative, and this will make you laugh, I'm sure, because it made me laugh when it was first pitched to me. Blockchains are also really good for fan engagement. And you've heard a lot about NFTs. NFTs can be used in a lot of innovative ways. So we've been pitched on all these different platforms that we're using this technology via blockchains to do kind of interesting fan engagement things. Then someone brought us a deal out of Korea that is using that technology for an entirely new K-pop studio.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a funny thing. But yeah. Korean culture has been exporting aggressively. Like yeah. Squid Games was the most ever watched Netflix show.
Yep.
But the K-pop industry specifically is massive and is rapidly internationalizing itself.
Yeah. For people who don't know K-pop, what is it?
I mean, it's just kind of pop music on steroids. I wouldn't know how to describe it differently than that.
Yeah.
It's massive in Asia.
Yep.
Now becoming massive in the Middle East, increasingly in Latin America. It's becoming a phenomenon that's being exported meaningfully.
Yeah.
So the fan engagement piece of these K-pop bands is so big that they'll release a new album, which will be a streaming-only thing, right? Because we live in a streaming-only world. But they'll issue 10 different versions of the physical CD.
Yeah.
And, like and the fans will buy all 10 versions of the CD. And they don't even have CD players.
Yeah, like
just because they want
a collectible.
Just to take pictures of themselves with the stack of CDs yeah. and post it.
Yeah.
Because it's all just proving fan engagement. So kind of perfect for a blockchain-based version of that. So there's a guy who was one of the original true godfathers of the whole creation of the K-pop movement, who was launching a new studio in which he was putting together the dream team of the best of all of the folks that build these bands. He was pulling from all the other firms, and he was establishing a new studio called Titan Content. So we were fascinated by it, but then we realized the cap table he'd started to put together. It is a who's who cap table for doing exactly this.
Yeah.
The studio owns all the revenue for all the artist revenue is owned by the studio first.
Jesus.
And they're building all this in a blockchain with a blockchain functionality that'll drive the entire world of fan engagement. The first bands that come out aren't going to be Korean bands. They're going to be international bands. So they'll have participants from different countries all over the world.
Yeah. This is like in sync, like at a whole other level.
And it's blockchain based. So,
dude, that is nuts.
That is so far outside of the lane of anything I thought I would be doing in a blockchain venture fund. But we led the round. I'm hugely bullish on what they're going to pull off. But again, there are some fundamental reasons for that. So when we think about like the things that are critical to us, first, it has to be a founder, and this is big for us, founders that are proven founders. You have to have proven you can be an entrepreneur in the past. Second, blockchain needs to matter to the build. And in this case, blockchain was kind of fundamental to the value creation. Third, it needs to be scalable to a huge TAM in some reasonable period of time. Fourth, we want to be attached to the revenue. There's a lot that happens in blockchain, which are like these governance tokens, which have no real revenue attachment. We don't do a lot of that because we want to be attached to revenue. We do think that some level of traditional financial modeling in terms of how to value businesses will come to the fore over time in this asset class. It hasn't yet.
Yeah.
So we try to invest in businesses today that are mindful of that. And then lastly, and these are kind of the five boxes of RW3. Lastly, we have to love the valuation coming in, and we have to believe that there's a path to an exit that's not 7 years from now and pray.
Yeah.
Right. So you get through all those five boxes, you have a TAM that's massive, you got a founder that's fantastic, we're attached to the revenue, the blockchain functionality we can help you build and is a big part of the value proposition of the disruption. It's interesting to us.
It's very early days for these game-changing technologies, and RW3 Ventures is at the forefront of it all. This is one of the biggest secular trends we've ever seen in our lifetime, making it a fascinating space to play in.
At Welcome to the Arena from ICR, we're working really hard to bring you exciting guests and great content. If you found this episode insightful, please subscribe to the show on your podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. The more the show grows, the more interesting voices we can have on the podcast, and in turn, that should demystify a lot of the stakeholders around public companies and soon-to-be public companies. Thank you so much for listening. I want to thank Pete Najarian for joining me today. What he's doing at RW3 Ventures is super exciting, a little bit risky, but he and his team have a great process and an excellent track record. They're in on the ground floor of what is likely to be massive value creation across the economy, and I can't wait to have him back on down the road so we can check in. This is Tom Ryan. We'll see you next time, back in the arena.
References to specific stocks are not intended to be recommendations for specific trading behavior. Comments presented on this podcast are intended for informational and educational purposes only, and do not represent opinions or recommendations on whether to buy, sell, or hold shares of a particular stock. All investors are advised to conduct their own independent research into individual stocks before making a trading decision. In addition, investors are advised that past stock performance is no guarantee of future price performance.
This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships, and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more.
While neither Tom Ryan nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor is Tom a client of IEQ Capital, ICR must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respected personal views and do not reflect the opinions or review of IEQ Capital.